Okay, thank you. Good morning. I'm Steve Emmert, and in this appeal, I represent a school division employee and his workers' compensation subrogate. We are all accustomed to seeing in numerous contexts where mighty issues turn upon very simple words. 15 or 20 years ago, we had a great battle over what the definition of is. Just last month, the Fourth Circuit Court of Appeals decided a case involving $10 million that turned on the definition of the. In this case, the word that matters is above. If you decide in this case that the word above, as reflected in the statute, means above, then this case has to be reversed and sent back to trial. If you determine that above means above or below or elsewhere in the code, then I'm going to lose. I'm not too worried about that given the context in which these statutes are. Since I think I've addressed most of the issues in the briefs, I'm not going to repeat the arguments that I've made, but I'll just address a couple of things and turn the matter over to the appellees. I want to make sure that there's a clear distinction between this case and the Leahy versus Johnson decision that was cited by the appellees. In that case, the court refused to look past the failure to file an extra $5 because the statute for habeas corpus proceedings requires that all court costs be paid. In this case, we have a very different matter. The statutes require two specific fees to be paid, the clerk's fee in section 17.1275 and the writ tax in section 58.1-1727. Those are the only fees that are mandatory to be collected at the time suit is filed. And yet, the trial court interpreted this term broadly. The word above would include above and elsewhere, and ruled that all of the fees that are traditionally associated with court costs must be paid at the beginning of suit. This is a decision originally made by the clerk of court and then effectively ratified by the trial court in this action. Now, in response to this, the appellees have argued that makes the clerk a creditor and creates an unwieldy circumstance where there's no specific deadline for the payment of some of these other fees that are not included. And maybe it is unwieldy. I don't think it's as unwieldy as they think. But as I pointed out in the reply brief, that's not a decision that we get to make. It's not a decision that you get to make. The decision is made across Ninth Street, and the legislature creates the circumstance that requires two specific fees and does not require prepayment of the others. In this case, the court theoretically can assess those costs, additional costs, at any time during the proceeding, including in final judgment. Final judgments typically do include an award of costs. But the court can't supersede the statutes and the rules that govern when the clerk files the case, when the fees must be paid.
What about Code Section 17.1275A13? It says that referring to those fees, and the question at this point is not the definition of above. It's a definition of those. Those fees shall be collected upon the filing of papers for the commencement of civil actions.
I've got the code section here. Where in that section are you? Is it near the top or bottom? I'm not sure.
I have
A13.
13.
Yes. The fees prescribed by the subdivision shall be charged upon the filing of the counterclaim. The fees prescribed above shall be collected upon the filing of papers for the commencement of civil action.
How does that affect your argument?
Well, I think it's the heart of my argument. The point is that the fees that are prescribed above, in this case, the clerk's fee of $300,
right,
has to be paid beforehand. There's a separate statute in the text, the title of taxation, 8.1.1727. It also requires that the writ tax be paid upon the commencement of every civil action in court record. Those are specific requirements.
Right, but 275D provides for the collection of the library assessment.
Correct. And D is below A13. What they're asking the court to do is to affirm based upon the fact that something that's below can be regarded as above. And that seems patently improper in my view. I hope that the court will agree with that, but in any event, it asks the court to rewrite the statute to say above or below or elsewhere in the code. That's something that this court can't do under the guise of construing or interpreting statutes. I should add before I leave that there's no interpretation or construction necessary because no party has asserted that any of these statutes are ambiguous. Under those circumstances, we don't construe, we don't interpret, we don't look to legislative intent. We simply apply the language.
In this case is a case where a $2 shortfall has kept this man out of court.
for a $2.5 million case. You're right. Exactly.
Thank you.
May I have leave to respond?
May I ask you a question?
Sure.
We seem to be referring to the fees as library fees. Does the record reflect that there is a judicial determination that they were library fees?
What I'll do is I want to look at the letter opinion and find that out. May I do that while the appellees are arguing? I'll give you an email. Thank you very much.
Good morning, Your Honors. My name is Chris McKenzie. I'm appearing today on behalf of Village X, Inc. and the Hallett Group. I'd like to advise the court that I've conferred with counsel for the other appellee, James & Permanent Corporation, and we'll be splitting our law firm. The issue before the court today, raised in the assignment of error, is but one, whether the library assessment is authorized by the Virginia Code is a mandatory predicate for fine. Now, before I begin responding to the felon's arguments, I'd like to briefly detail a few of the areas where both parties are in agreement. Factually, both parties agree that the complaint was mailed to the clerk prior to the expiration of the statute of limitations. The parties also agree.
That was 9 days before, received at least 9 days before the expiration.
Yes,
of the
Your
statute,
Honor.
And then sat in the clerk's office for those 9 days.
Yes, Your Honor. If I recall correctly, September 3rd it was received, and the plaintiff was contacted on September 9th. The parties agree on that. The parties also agree that that complaint was accompanied by a check for a filing fee. It said just filing fee, and that check was $2 deficient. And finally, the parties agree that that deficiency was not remedied until after the expiration of the statute of limitations. More importantly, there are a few legal issues that the parties agree on. Chief among them is the clerk's fee. Both sides agree that the clerk's fee is a mandatory predicate and runs in the civil action. That's based on Code Section 275A13, which is really the cornerstone of this case, as Mr. Emmerich pointed out. That code section states that the clerk's fee, among others, will be charged to plaintiffs in civil actions, and also states, importantly, quote, the fees prescribed above shall be collected from the filing of papers for the commencement of civil action. The parties also agree that writ tax is similarly a mandatory predicate to the filing of civil action. These are the areas of agreement. The bone of contention in this case is whether the remaining fees that constitute the colloquial clerk's fee are also mandatory predicates, or whether they can be paid at some other time later on in the proceedings. Specifically, the assignment of error addresses the library assessment. Although I would like to point out that throughout this proceeding, the appellees have maintained that the clerk was not in a position at the time of filing to attribute the deficiency specifically to the library assessment. She simply received a check that said filing fees. It was $2 short. It was $344. The amount of the total filing fee in that jurisdiction at that time was $346. Through research during the trial court and from a letter of opinion produced by Judge Sella, it was later discovered that the difference between the Salem filing fee and the Powhatan filing fee was the library assessment, $4 in Powhatan and $2 in Salem, and thus in a latter examination, it was determined that likely the culprit was the library assessment. But I think it's important to remember that at the time the clerk was handed these papers, he or she was not in a position to make that determination. Setting that aside, the assignment of error addresses the library assessment. I'll respond to that specifically. The appellant raises essentially two arguments. The chief of them is the word above contained in subsection A13. I understand that contention, but I think it disregards a similarly important provision, subsection D, and the words contained therein. Specifically,
The clerk of the court marked this complaint filed. Was the mark by the clerk affixed to the document before the statute of limitations ran?
I don't know for sure, Your Honor, but I believe it was stamped September 13th, and that I would assume that that stamp was done on the same day.
When did the statute of limitations run?
September 9th or 10th.
I think it was September 9th.
Thank you.
So the $2 check representing some deficiency of something was sent to the clerk?
Yes. I believe that the check was accompanied by a letter dated September 10th, and it was mailed on that day, and then it was received a day or two after that.
All right.
So, counsel, if the clerk's office took several days to determine there was a deficiency.
Yes, Your Honor.
And clerk's office notified, but no one said statute of limitations is running today.
Not to my knowledge. However, I would like to point out that that call did come on the day the statute of limitations was set to expire. So there was an opportunity to cure that deficiency before the expiration of statute of limitations by, as opposed to mailing in the check, having it hand-delivered that day. I'd like to just briefly address the above and below language. The language of subsection 275D in that same code section states that in accordance with section 42.170, which is a separate code section dealing with the purpose and amount of the library fee, the clerk shall collect fees under subdivision A13 to be designated for public law libraries. We maintain that that phrase, under subdivision A13, incorporates the library assessment into the provisions of section 813. In other words, it becomes one of the fees prescribed above. Although it is not literally listed there, subsection D incorporates it there. I'd like to point out that the other fees that constitute the colloquial filing fee, which are the courthouse maintenance fee and the fee for legal aid, are similarly addressed in subsections B and C of that same statute with identical language. Therefore, pursuant to our reading, the statute operates as a continuous and harmonious whole by integrating these fees into not only the civil action statute in 813, but the way the statute is written allows the fees to be applied into various other areas. You'll note if you read section 275D that it also references subsection A7 and subsection A16. Those have to do with garnishment proceedings, I believe, and habeas proceedings. The way the statute is written allows that the library assessment can be applied into various different forms of actions, and it enables the clerk to collect that assessment in various forms of action, and this form of drafting prevents the drafters from having to write in library assessment into each code provision addressing each of these separate types of actions. So our position is that subsections A13 and subsections 275D must be read together. And when they're read together, A13 is modified and expanded to include both the clerk's fee and the library assessment and the courthouse maintenance fee and legal aid fee for that matter. And that because the parties agree that A13 creates a mandatory predicate to filing, both the clerk's fees and the library assessment are mandatory predicates. I'll say one more point. On the clerk as a creditor issue, which we have raised before. And we believe that the legislative intent is relevant insofar as the court is asked to analyze these statutes. And we think that it's unlikely that the General Assembly would have tried to place such an unruly burden on clerks in asking them to collect the clerk's fees and the writ tax before filing, but other fees at some other indeterminate point in time. And further, not giving them a mechanism to collect those fees absent some kind of show cause order or other statement mandating that a litigant pay these other fees. I think this is especially instructive in light of the simple mechanism of requiring that all fees be paid at the time of filing. And unless there are any other questions from the court, I will turn the lectern over to my colleague.
Good morning, may it please the court. My name is J.H. Revere with Kalboff under Messersmith, and I represent FLE James Pemberton Court. I'm not going to retread any of the fee argument. What I do want to very briefly touch upon is I asserted to the lower court a Rule 1:1 argument. When the writ went up, I went through a long anguished analysis and could not determine whether I could preserve that argument without noticing it for the appeal, and so I did so, and my understanding is that was granted. I do think it bears mentioning that all of the facts in this case, when the fee was paid, the statute of limitations, the file stamp, all of that occurred in a case that was filed in 2010 and non-suited in 2011. And this court has previously ruled that Rule 1:1, finality of judgments, does in fact apply to non-suited actions. Now, the cases that I've cited, and I couldn't find any that dealt with this exact issue, but dealt with cases where more than one non-suit was granted. And this very court has addressed it, I believe as recently as 2006, and said, once there's 21 days, Ryan, you can't vacate that non-suit order, and they got two bites at the apple. And I recognize that a dismissed action, a non-suited action, may not contain a lot of things in it for the finality under Rule 1:1. But certainly it would seem to me that it would have two things. One, it would have a final order with a date for that final order that somebody could reliably use the date of that final order for calculations as you did in the 1:1 cases previously, the running of the 21 days. And it seems to me that the other thing that that case would need to have would be a starting point. What's that starting date? And that starting date would be the date of the file stamp complaint. And it seems to me that this dispute runs from this file stamp complaint and whether the clerk properly file stamped it on the date that she file stamped it. And I submit to the court that when she file stamped it, it may well have been attackable for all of these reasons, but it seems to me that the time to have addressed it and the time to have attacked it was during the course of that initial lawsuit. Once they non-suit the case and the 21 days runs, it seems to me that that's the end of it, and they've essentially tacitly agreed that the filing date of the original complaint was, I believe it's September 10th, 2010. And at this point, that would be the date. And it seems to me that Rule 1 should prevent them from going back and attacking what is essentially an ended lawsuit, a lawsuit that was started and ended. If anybody has any questions, I'm happy to try and address them.
Oh, I have one collateral question, I guess. I know Mr. Emmert was not involved in this trial, and he's here on appeal trying to save a client of somebody else's at that time. But the reason why I add that is the judge's letter, he makes a lot out of how the plaintiff in the case is not very sympathetic because they were always pushing the outer bounds of procedural filings and finally caught up with them. And my question to you is that relevant to any question that we have to answer in this case? Whether the equities are balanced improperly or the plaintiff is sympathetic or not sympathetic? Is that just the trial judge's aside, or is that significant?
I believe that that would be a trial judge's aside, Your Honor. I would think I'm not the expert on the fee issue, and I may have a minute or two here to see back to Mr. McKenzie if you want to ask him the same question as to that. But certainly as to the Rule 1:1 argument, I think it is what it is, and it doesn't matter why.
All right.
Thank you.
Thank you. Your time, you have more time, but you finished. Thank you very much. Mr. Emmer.
Thank you. Let me begin by answering Madam Justice Lacey's question about what resolution of the issue, whether it was regarded as the library fee or not. The answer is on page 75, in which the judge assumes without deciding that issue. So that was specifically laid out in the letter opinion. But the ultimate issue in this case is, was the check that was received sufficient to cover all of the mandatory prepayment fees? If it was, then it doesn't matter which of the other non-mandatory prepayment fees was stiffed by $2. It doesn't matter. All the mandatory requirements for filing for commencement of an action were then achieved. And the only mandatory fees in this case are $300 for the clerk's fee and $25 for the writ fees. The check was $364, which is ample to cover. Mr. McKenzie indicated that the plaintiff's lawyer had an opportunity to correct the deficiency because she received a phone call on the due date. Now, frankly, I don't know what time of day that call was received. It was on the limitations date, the 9th of September. The record will indicate I'm comfortable that Powhatan County is where the clerk's office was, and the lawyer's office was in Salem near Roanoke. So I can honestly tell you that if there had been notice that the suit had not been filed that day, then somebody would have been driving in a car as quickly as possible with $2 in American money in his fist, ready to file that and to cure that.
If the clerk had called the attorney on the day that the letter arrived, or the day after the letter arrived, even the day after the letter arrived, there would have been several days for the attorney to get $2 to the clerk's office.
Absolutely. Exactly. The clerk didn't do that. She waited until the anniversary of the second anniversary of the injury. And there was, the only information that the clerk gave them was, you're $2 short, not, we haven't filed your suit. That's not what the record indicates here. The only information was, you're $2 short, send me more money. And the first notice that anyone on the plaintiff's side had of this delayed filing came not in the non-suited action. It came when the plea and bar was filed in this action. This is something that Mr. Revere referred to as well. Whether the plea and bar in this case was where the real error was made. It was, because what the trial court should have done in the refiled action was regarded that suit as having been, the first suit, as having been commenced when all the statutory and rules-based requirements for commencing the suit had happened. And that was receipt by the clerk, unambiguously, 6 days before the statute. Payment of all the mandatory prepayment fees, also 6 days before the suit. And the trial court, in this case, mistakenly refused to regard that first suit as having been commenced on that date when all those prerequisites were met. So,
Mr. Emmert, I noticed that in the record you come into the case after the judge made the initial ruling on a motion to rehear, and that's where these initial arguments you're making now were made and consequently preserved in trial court. The reason why I asked the question of your opponents is I'm wondering if the argument that the interpretation of this code provision and what the word above means was somehow influenced by what the trial court thought was the equities of the case. And if that were the case, then the question that I ask is that an issue of any sort in the interpretation of the statute, or is it entirely irrelevant?
It should be irrelevant. I'm not blind, however, and it's completely clear to me that the judge was looking at that as one other reason. It's not a sympathetic argument because you waited so long on each of these stages, and yet each of them is timely. The law doesn't regard you as having been derelict in your duty if you file the day before the statute of limitations expires. You're allowed to do that. And so it's abundantly clear to me that the judge was at least considering that, but it's not a consideration that should affect how this case ultimately should come out.
So your position presumably is that all of the fees above are necessary to stop the running of the statute of limitations and have a valid claim. Anything left over might very well be required in order to proceed thereafter, but it does not knock you out of court.
Correct. The court could very well have assessed those costs, as it routinely does, for example, in criminal cases, upon final judgment. Those are when costs are assessed in those things. And court costs includes more than just these two identifiable specific fees. Oral argument is always the best part of my practice, and I appreciate you making it so again today.
Court is adjourned.
All rise.